So we had learned that Barak gathered the tribe of Zvulun and Naphtali to a place called Kadesh, and he has 10,000 men with Devorah the prophetess. And we have the family of Jethro, the family of Yisro, that's living in tents. Remember, they were nomads. And they were friendly with Sisera, the chief general from the north, from Yavin, the king of Canaan. And Sisera charges forward with his 900 metal chariots to the Kishon Valley. And Dvorah tells Barak, go ahead. This is the day you're going to be victorious. And Barak charges down from Mount Tabor with his 10,000 men. And Hashem stuns the camp. Meteors start shooting down. The Kishon Valley, which at this time of year is ordinarily dry, suddenly gets a flood that runs through it and just wipes his troops off their feet and kills out the troops. A tremendous number of troops were just killed by the waters that came down the Kishon Valley. And Sisera's men are decimated. And Sisera runs. And he runs to the tent of his good friend Chever from the family of Jethro. And Chever isn't home, but his wife Yael is home. And there was a peace treaty between the Canaanites and the Cainy family. So Yael comes out towards him and she says, come here, my master, come, don't worry. And he comes to her tent and she covers him basimicha. What is simicha? Modern Hebrew, simicha is a blanket. But in the Tanakh, the word simicha doesn't appear. This is the only place that the word simicha appears in all of Tanakh. What is simicha? So one tradition had it that simicha is two words put together. Shmi ko. God says, my name is here, I testify nothing improper happened between Yoel and Sisera. But the Talmud tells us that Yoel seduced Sisera, meaning that's one tradition in the Medrash. The Talmud goes the exact opposite route. The Talmud says quite the contrary. When it says she covered him, what is simicha? It means she covered him with herself. And afterwards, she wanted to get him all thirsty and to wear him down. He was, as we said earlier, as big a threat as the whole army. He was such a brilliant general that he alone could have regrouped men, charged and won the people of Israel. He was a bigger threat, even though we won the army. If we wouldn't have him, then our situation was dire. So he's thirsty. He asks her for water and she purposely gives him some milk to drink. Today we know about serotonin. And she covers him yet again, which again, our sages have a tradition on what that means. And he tells her, you stand by the entrance to the tent. If anyone comes and asks if anyone's around, you tell her no one's here. So Yael goes out, takes out the spoke from the tent, and takes a hammer in her hand. Women, ideally, don't carry weapons. A woman's not supposed to dress like a man. The Torah knew that if women would be a part of the army, there would be tremendous promiscuity and improper things going on. So the Torah said a woman can be supportive of an army. She can prepare the food, she can do a lot of things, but she shouldn't be on the front lines holding weapons. So Yael, with that spirit, prefers to do her job with a spoke. So she takes this long, sharp spoke and the hammer. Now, it's also more natural if he suddenly awakens, she could tell him, oh, the spoke came out, could you help me knock it in? So she comes, and she leans over, and she puts the spoke by his temple, and takes the hammer, and bam! He's in a deep sleep, and the spoke goes through his head into the ground. She's a powerful woman, right? And Barak is running, looking for Sisera. And Yael comes out to greet him and says, come on, go, I'll show you the man you're seeking. And he comes, and there is Sisera standing up, you know, like they have for Purim, those darts that go through your head, you know, those hats. So that's what Sisera looked like. He's walking around with this spoke coming out of the two sides of his temple. And boom, he falls dead. And with that, we have really had a victory against the Canaanites. What did you say?
He wasn't dead?
No. When Ehud walked in, when Barak walked in, Sisera fell dead with the spoke in his head. So this was the turning of the tide from here on in. we were able to be victorious against the Canaanites, against Yavin, the king of Canaan. And now we have the famous song of Devorah. So Devorah describes that when we volunteer to do tshuva, when the people of Israel volunteered to return to Hashem, that's when things went right. She says, she describes how the great miracles of the giving of the Torah at Sinai. And now she says, but what we had here on the mountain of Tabor was also a great miracle. Because the state of the people was such that people were scared of going on the regular streets. They tried to go in circular ways to avoid the enemy. People ran away from cities that were unfortified. Until I came along, says Devorah. Until I came along, a mother in Israel. Our sages say she shouldn't have said that sentence. Because she said that sentence, she lost her prophecy. Because she was proud in her song. Whatever that means, on her level, this was a level of pride that shouldn't have been expressed. So, she says, why were we in such trouble? Why were we fighting these wars? Because the people of Israel chose themselves new gods. And then that's when all this trouble started. Now, technically, we shouldn't have won this war because no one had a spear or a shield. 40,000 soldiers, no one has weapons. But we won the war because of those who write the laws in Israel, the leaders who help them do tshuva. All the people should now speak about this great victory. Because originally people were scared to go draw water, lest the enemy hear them out by the stream and come attack. Now that people could go and draw water peacefully, that's where they should show their praise to Hashem. The kindness that He's done for us, that we could return to our cities without fortification. Now, arouse, arouse, Dvorah. She tries to arouse her own prophecy because she's losing it. Barak, you go out and grab your hostages, your captives. Hashem is the one that gave the power, the might to our brave men. She says, she recounts the different leaders that fought our enemies, and she praises the tribe of Yisachar, who joined the war. She rebukes the tribe of Reuven, who was on the eastern side of the Jordan, and they were prepared to run in case we lost the war instead of joining us. What were you waiting for? You were waiting to see who would win the war. What a terrible thing, instead of joining your brethren. The people of Gilad, they also said, we're on the other side of the Jordan, let's just wait it out and see what happens. The tribe of Dan was waiting by the seaside, ready to jump on ships to flee in case we lost the war. The tribe of Asher went to the port cities to see where they could catch a ship to run away in case we lost. Which tribe risked their lives? The tribe of Zvulun, the tribe of Naphtali, and kings volunteered to join Sisera. Sisera offered pay, and our neighbors said, we will come for free just to destroy Israel. Hashem said, you're coming for free. I'll fight you with my army that's for free. And so Hashem shifted the stars. Our sages have a tradition that there was a shift in the constellations at this war, which is what caused the Kishon Valley to overflow out of nature. This shouldn't have happened that time of year, and that's why we won the war. The horses were overrun, the chariots were overrun, and there was another star that should have shifted but wouldn't come to our assistance. That star, his name was Meiros, and so she curses the star. God wanted it to be a greater victory, but you didn't participate. Another tradition has it that Meiros was a wealthy person who lived nearby, and he had many soldiers, and he could have volunteered the soldiers for the war, but he didn't. He said, I'm sending this one out. And so she curses him, and she places him in halachic ostracism. How could it be that we're fighting Hashem's war, and you sit on the sidelines? Bless. Yes. Some of the halachos of Cherem are learned from this pasuk. Oru Meiros. Yes. He asked for water. She gave him milk to put him to sleep. And she wiped out Sisera. Now she concludes her song with the story of Sisera's mother, who sat by the windowsill wondering, why hasn't my son returned? And her assistants tell her, and she comforts herself, must be there's so much loot in Israel. Must be there are so many women to rape that they don't have time to come back home. So this cruelty at the hands of our enemies, that a mother, instead of having mercy on the daughters of Israel, that's her comfort to herself. Must be that's what he's busy with. He can't come home yet. So it must be he's going to bring me home so many new colored scarves from all the women he's taken. She concludes her song and says, just like she is wrong, so too all your enemies, Hashem, should be destroyed, and those that love you should be like the sunrise, where it keeps getting stronger and stronger. As the sun rises, so too those that love Hashem should keep getting stronger and stronger in their service of Hashem, and we have peace for 40 years. Now Sisera's mother sheds some tears. We have a tradition that even a wicked person, when they shed tears, it has a weight in heaven. Tears have a weight that nothing else has. Esav shed some tears when Yaakov steals the blessing for him. Years later, Mordechai will go on the street and shed identical tears. Why is it that we have the whole story of Purim? It's a payback for Yaakov stealing the blessings. Yaakov stole the blessings from Esav and got Esav to cry. So the psukim are almost identical with when it describes Mordechai's weeping in the streets. Mordechai's weeping in the streets was a payback for making Esav weep. Anytime a person sheds tears, true tears, so then in heaven it has an impact. So Sisera's mother is weeping by the windowsill. The Kabbalists say that the extra blasts of the shofar that we blow every year are corresponding to her tears. For whatever reason, her tears could have had a negative impact to affect the people of Israel, and we blow extra blasts of the shofar, and that's an expression of our tears. The Torah, the shofar blasts are called tearful blasts. The shofar is supposed to be representative of a weeping person. A cry is something that's the most natural. I was going to leave this for the Rosh Hashanah class, but we'll describe it now. Imagine you want the keys for the car on a Saturday night. You come to your father and you say, "Dad, I want to go out tonight." And your father says, "No, it's late, and you never fill the gas before you come home. And anyways, you should be studying more. No, go back. You're not going out tonight." So your sister wants to go out tonight. So your sister says, she walks into your father and says, "Dad?" And she starts crying. She doesn't say a word. Your father comes over and says, "Susie, what's wrong? What happened?" She cries some more. "Susie, what's wrong? Tell me. What's so terrible? Come on." She cries some more. "Susie, come on, what's bothering you so deeply?" He's already ready to give her the car and the gas and whatever she wants. Why? Because a tear expresses an emotion without any logic. You'll talk to me logic, I have answers. You talk emotion, you talk to me about how you feel, you talk to me about how something's hurting you, I have no answers. "Well, Dad, I know you're not going to give me the car, but you know, I promised my friends, I was planning on going out with my friends, I had a hard week." She already won the case. She already started crying. The shofar is the tear. The shofar is what goes beyond any claims of logic. It's not about logic. It's about, this is how I feel. I'm hurting. And when someone's hurting, then you ordinarily want to help them. It's not about whether you agree with them logically or not. So that's what we're doing on Rosh Hashanah. We're crying. We're not coming with logical claims. Okay, so after 40 years of guidance under Dvorah, we're quick to return to our old ways, and the people start sinning again, and they're given in the hands of the Midianites. Now, the Midianites were nomadic tribes, and they'd come in with all their camels and devour anything they could find. So the people started going into caves throughout the mountains in order to hide their food, because when the Midianites came, they'd check out every house and they'd check out the barn and everything. Anytime we try to plant, they'd come with Amalekim and destroy all our crops. So people were going to die. There was no food left. They'd take all the cattle. They had so many people, you couldn't even count them. So we were in dire need because of them. They called out to Hashem. And Hashem sent the prophet and said, look at all the good I've done for you. I've saved you from the Egyptians. I chased everyone out of the land. I said, be faithful to me. Don't worship the pagan gods here. You didn't listen. So Hashem, so to speak, says, make it work or do tshuva. Nothing doing so far. So an angel shows up to the eastern side of the Jordan to Yoash. And Yoash has a son named Gidon, and Gidon is helping his father prepare food to hide from the Midianites. And the angel appears to Gidon and says, God is with you, brave warrior. Now, we're talking about the morning of Pesach. So Gidon says, he doesn't recognize the angel, and he says, my master, if God's with us, why are we in such a state right now? And where are all the wonders? Last night I sat with my father for the Seder, and he told me about how God took us out of Egypt, even though we weren't deserving. So if God helps people, even though they're not deserving, why isn't he helping us now? And if we are deserving, so he should help us by our own merits. If we aren't deserving, so God helps even so. How come God's leaving us to suffer like this? So Hashem appears to him and says, ah, you've made the claim that'll change the course of the tide. The tradition we have is that sometimes one person can say a prayer that'll change things in heaven. Every one of us has a responsibility to try. You never know which one is going to break through. Which goes back to the whole idea. We don't know how God works. But what we are given certain indications. One of the things we're taught by the prophets is that prayers do make an impact, and you never know which one's going to do it. So God tells them, okay, you have a point. You've made the claim. So with that claim, you're going to go and conquer Midian. I've sent you. So Gidon turns to the angel and says to him, how? Because he said that claim. If we're no worse than them, you save them, save us. If we have our own merits, save us by our own merits. If not, then you've taught us that you save. Right. So sometimes it's a question, Hashem waits for us to find the right way to make the claim. And if you think about it, there's meaning to that. If you care, you think about how to get there. There's more to it than that. Every prayer has an element of self-exploration. Meaning, in order to pray, you have to really believe Hashem exists and is involved in the world. So when you take the time to invest your energies in the prayer, part of that is also a declaration, I realize you're running the world. And that maybe is part of the reason why we call tefillah. What does the word tefillah mean? Tefillah means really attaining self-clarity. Tefillah. Lefalel means to attain external clarity. Tefillah could be interpreted to mean finding internal clarity. There's an element of doubt that a person lives with throughout his life. Does God really exist? Is he really listening? Does he really care? Does he really run the world? So we don't say that. We say, yeah, I believe in it. And right, well, we say that. But there are levels, you understand? That there are different levels. You can say, I accept it 10%, I accept it 90%, I accept it 99%. But to reach that 100%, where I'm 100% sure he's running the world and everything is, that's very hard. I don't know if it's even possible. It's levels of, you're talking about 100% certainty. Okay, so that deserves a whole class as to what level of certainty a person can really attain. You don't attain 100% certainty about anything really in your life. What we call 100% is not really 100%. When you open a milk carton, you don't know there's going to be milk inside. When you take medicine the doctor gives you, you're not 100% certain what medicine is in there. You're not 100% about anything in your life, yet you do it. You drink the Coke and you assume it's not cyanide. Are you sure? You're not sure. You take the medicine, you assume it's Tylenol, but maybe it's cyanide. Are you sure? You're not sure. So there are many things that we risk our lives on, and we don't call it risking our lives, because you there's a level of certainty that we treat as 100%, even though it's not 100%. There's really nothing in our lives that's 100%. Yeah, makes sense? Yeah? Okay, so that's... okay, but that's for a class in philosophy. It's not for this. At any rate, so... Gidon is told, go. And Gidon says, how? I'm from the smallest part of the tribe of Menashe, and I'm the youngest in the family. So he tells him, right, I'm not talking about you. I'm going to be with you. It's me, God says. It's not you. That's the same answer God gives Moshe. You keep saying you're not worthy. I'm not talking about you. It's me who's going to be with you. And you will destroy the Midianites as though they were an individual. And Gideon says, okay, so give me a sign. So I'm going to bring an offering, and please wait. So he says, fine, I'll wait. He offers an offering, and the angel tells him, put it all on a rock and pour the gravy over it. And he does that, and the angel extends his staff. He touches the food, the matzah and the meat. They're eating matzah, it's Pesach, right? And a fire explodes from the rock, and everything's consumed, and the angel disappears. And then Gideon realizes it's an angel. He says, whoa, I've seen an angel. And God tells him everything's going to be okay. He thought it was a prophet, which deserves another discussion, because Maimonides says angels never take on physical form, and when a person gets prophecy, what? That's where the Ramban discusses it. We'll discuss it when we hit Parshas Vayera, God willing. If you want, you could see previous classes on Vayera. In Parshas Vayera, that's where we'll discuss Maimonides and Nachmanides' opinion, whether angels take on physical form. And this is one of the questions on Maimonides, that here it seems like the angel did. And we'll pick up here, Bezat Shem, next week.